Hey, I'm Bob Runkel, and for as long as I can remember, I've loved pop culture. Despite the challenges I've faced in my life, pop culture has always been there for me. I love talking to people and being a platform for others to share their thoughts, stories. Because if there's one thing I never get tired of, it's seeing driven, talented, and inspiring individuals follow their dreams, no matter what obstacles are in their way. And I know a thing or two about that. Welcome to the DJ Bob Show. I'm DJ Bob. Roll it. Michael Latini and Mark Petrucchino are the guys that are monkeying around. Yeah, you knew that was coming. The owners of Monkey Boys Productions are here, and they talk about their work on Saturday Night Live, their creative process, helpsters for Apple TV Plus, and punk rock, among other things. Enjoy this one. I love these two. They're great. And thank you to past guest Michael Shupak for connecting us. For those that don't know you, could the both of you introduce yourself, who you are, and what you've done over the years? It's kind of amazing.
My name's Mark Petrucchino. I've been a professional puppeteer for, I guess it's 26 years now. I grew up doing community theater with my parents. And of course, like all of us, grew up loving the Muppets and Fraggle Rock and Sesame Street. And, you know, we also grew up in the era of great practical effects. So with all of that love, I, of course, went to school for marine biology, which is the natural progression to become a puppeteer.
Yeah, typical.
Science was my other love. And I, you know, when I was coming out of high school back then, there were only maybe 8 or 12 professional puppeteers or that did regular television work. And I was like, there's no chance I'm going to break into that. So I'll do this more realistic thing and be a scientist, and got partway through it and realized it wasn't what I wanted to do. And transferred to a school where I could create my own major, and I created a puppetry degree. And then volunteered at the O'Neill puppetry conference. And through that, gained a lot of experience, met a lot of great people, and started getting the chance to audition for all sorts of stuff. And one of my first big professional gigs was with Basil Twist, doing Petrushka at Lincoln Center and other places. And from there, kept auditioning, getting different jobs. And Marty Robinson, I became friends with him at the O'Neill, and he invited me to audition for A Little Shop of Horrors. And by this point, I was living with Michael and two other guys, Scott Hitz and Russell Tucker. And the four of us founded Monkey Boys Productions back in 06. So when we got, Mike and I wound up doing Little Shop together. And when we got off the road with that, the four of us started Monkey Boys Productions and went through all of the ups and downs of that. All while that was happening, I was lucky enough to perform on the side. I've been able to do a little handful of work with Sesame Street and the Muppets. And I've done lots of shows at the Metropolitan Opera. And more recently, we've done a lot of performance work with Saturday Night Live because we built a lot of stuff for them. So we've been very lucky to be afforded the chances, the opportunities.
My name's Michael Latini. I've done a lot of things over the years, but a quick little rundown about how I got to where I am now is I grew up doing a lot of theater starting around middle school. I started doing theater, and I did both backstage, stage crew work and also on stage performance, while at the same time working with my dad in home remodeling. I ended up going to an art school in Pennsylvania, in the Philadelphia area.
While I was there, I focused on small sculpture and jewelry. I got a degree in jewelry, metals, and computer-aided design. And then while I was there, in between my junior and senior year, is when I figured out that puppetry was a possibility as a job. Never really noticing that all the things I grew up loving, like the Muppets and Sesame Street and Fraggle Rock and Jaws and Jurassic Park and Star Wars and Dark Crystal and Labyrinth, all these things that I really loved so much were that I could possibly work there. So I started telling people that I wanted to be a puppeteer, and I told the right person, and I got a volunteer position at the National Puppetry Conference up at the Eugene O'Neill Theater Center in Connecticut, which is where I met Mark and the other founding members of Monkey Boys, Scott Hitz and Russell Tucker. And then it was pretty much, you know, from there on, I met the right people and had the right skills and learned how the puppetry industry worked and how to get work in it, both performing and then also building. And I definitely didn't work full time the whole time. I was still doing home remodeling with my dad and jumping between that and then working in, you know, theater carpentry work in off-Broadway houses, building puppets at the same time, performing in puppet shows at the same time, which got to a point where myself and Mark and the other founding members of Monkey Boys decided to start the company back in 2006. And then we started that company. It was, you know, very slow project to project for about a decade that then slowly built up to becoming a full-time company about 7 years ago now. And we've grown to the size of having about 30 employees outside of Mark and myself.
And the thing that I love about your company is that it's so versatile. You could do Little Shop, and then you could do something like Helpsters, which is totally unique and eccentric and fun. So it's got to be fun going into work every day knowing that there's a new challenge.
It's definitely what keeps us interested. Mike and I now do a lot of administrative work since we're running the company, and we've been lucky enough to find very talented builders who are generally much more skilled than us. So while we may have knowledge and whatnot, they often can be more effective practically. So having those opportunities to try and problem solve really helps to drive us and keep things interesting. Especially we work with Saturday Night Live, and that is a really truncated timeline for working on stuff. So it's a very high pressure problem solving situation. But yeah, the spectrum of stuff we get to do is wonderful. I mean, even beyond, one of the things that helped us grow as a company was when we realized we could make props and practical effects and things like that. Before that, we had only focused on puppets. And while we got some work in that, it was when we opened up and realized we could do these other things that we really started to grow. And in doing so, it made our puppet building better and obviously grew the company.
What is the weirdest prop you've ever been contracted to do? Like, what is the weirdest sort of job? Like, they want us to make this?
That happens most weeks with SNL. Boy, weirdest prop. We've had to make some awful things and some offensive things for SNL. It was all in the name of comedy. Weird wise, everything is weird. It'll be like, you have to make a cake that looks like, you know, a melted snowman or a degrading cookie monster. We've had to make miniature rats to look kind of like Ratatouille that also have on top of them an even smaller bug that manipulates the Ratatouille rat. Trying to think of weirder stuff. We had to make a base. They did a parody sketch one time for Alive. Do you remember that movie from the 90s about the soccer team that crashes and they wind up having to resort to cannibalism.
Yep.
So we had to coordinate. They have all these very specialized people that work with SNL, and one of the people specializes in making edible things, you know, that look like normal things. And we had to basically make a body that had a platform where the person's butt should be. And then this other person had to make a butt out of, I think it was like deli turkey or something like that.
Beautiful, beautiful.
And so we had to, you know, make sure it all coordinated and was the right, you know, skin tone and everything. Yeah, all sorts. Every week is something really, like, really weird.
Yeah, we've been lucky enough to work with Sarah Sherman a bunch, and some of her stuff is really out of there. And one of the best things that she's done more recently is the meatball skin tag head people that sang the song, and that was just so awesome because it was like just wonderful combination of an awesomely written sketch with some fun puppetry and practical and special effects and video effects and stuff like that.
And I know our good friend Noel McNeil helped out a couple of times doing some of that stuff.
Yeah, it's great having, you know, friends in the business that we can be like, hey, what are you doing tomorrow? You want to come play and fool around at 8H?
That's gotta be so fun. Because the puppetry community, like, is so small. Everybody knows each other, but it creates this great network of people. It's got to be really cool for you guys just to have that kind of support system.
Absolutely. And that I was just going to say that it's so supportive. Like, we were lucky that when we first went to the O'Neill, we got to meet people like Pam Arciero and Marty Robinson and Fred Thompson and all of these people that were like, yeah, you can learn this. You can do this. Try this. Here's a trick I learned. Here's a professional guideline you should follow, which will help to make sure that, you know, you can hopefully keep getting work. And having people like that as mentors was huge. And then along the way, you know, we have, you know, like you mentioned, Michael Shupak connected us, his former company, Puppet Kitchen, with Emily DeCola and Eric Wright. We're, you know, competitors in a sense, but we're also colleagues, and we would constantly help each other out, you know, whether it was advice or, you know, hey, here's some work that we may not be able to do. Would you like to do it? It's a great community.
So for the both of you, puppetry was such a big part of pop culture in the 80s, in the 70s, 80s, 90s. But what were some of your formative puppet things that people don't talk about?
For me, I lean a lot towards the Muppet Show and Sesame Street and Fraggle Rock, but that feels like that's what everyone leans towards. And then I realize more that what really, like, grew and fostered my love for puppetry was all the practical effects in films where you might not know their puppetry. And, you know, the original Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles movie. I remember loving that, and that being one of the, like, earlier movies that maybe put out like an awesome behind the scenes featurette, so you could see how they were making the puppets and costume characters and how they were puppeteering them with the new Waldo system. It always seemed like something that was, you know, people were literally, you know, in a workshop building magic for movies and stuff like that. And that's definitely what I think is more responsible for what I'm doing today versus just watching the children's television shows I grew up on.
I was lucky enough that with community theater, my parents did, they knew people that were actually puppeteers that would go around and do, you know, shows and live events. So I was lucky to see it in person too, along with what Mike's talking about. And just, you know, enjoy that. There's something about live theater, the electricity and the breath that you share with people, that just is a whole different experience. So to see, you know, these inanimate things come to life in front of your eyes too, without editing, was really exciting. And I remember my dad used to do, once in a while, he would do the summer stock theater in our town, the regional theater. And one year they did Little Shop of Horrors when I was still relatively young, and he played Mushnick, And I remember going to see that show and see Audrey too, you know, there in the quote unquote flesh, and just being blown away, really, you know, helped to stoke my love of puppetry.
For me, because, you know, I'm 28, so puppetry was still a big part of television when I was growing up. I mean, one of the last major puppet shows that kind of made a big splash was Bear in the Big Blue House. That show was massive.
Yeah.
So and like, do you think that there's a comeback as far as puppetry? Because I remember hearing Children's Television Network executives literally say in their pitch meetings, no puppets. But I think that's more of a thing of the past. Do you think there's more puppets, or do we need more of them?
I hope it's a thing of the past. There's definitely been a swing back that we've seen. You know, Mike and I, when we were younger, we saw that first real growth, the first wave of CG and CG animation, like, you know, with Jurassic Park, and everybody's like, you know, this is going to be the end, like you're talking about. But part of what made Jurassic Park brilliant was their incorporation with practical. You know, they did a CG Tyrannosaurus Rex, but they also had a practical monster, a big metal and latex monster that people could interact with certain shots. And I think while there was that massive initial push, it's kind of bounced back where the industry realized, oh yeah, we do need the practical still. We can enhance it where we need to, but there's that breath again, that, you know, similar to live theater, that if it's not there, it's harder for the audience to suspend their disbelief. So yeah, here's hoping there's more puppetry. I mean, otherwise we're out of luck.
Right. I feel like right now it's so hard to tell, especially with what's going on with the, you know, I feel with what's going on with the strikes, but with what's going on with all the new media outlets, it seems like everyone is open to everything and a lot more is getting produced. So I hope that means that people continue to still love puppetry as it's presented almost more equally with all the cartoons and CG work that's out there. Because I mean, I feel pretty confident that all the people our age and even a little younger that grew up with more puppet children's television, realize that they love it, and why they love it is because it's a tangible thing and not a two-dimensional cartoon or something like that.
For sure. So for the both of you, what was your first interaction with the Muppet?
At the O'Neill, like Marty and Pam had brought Telly and Grinchetta up there and then had done some live bits. I think that's the first time ever in person seeing a Muppet outside of, you know, like maybe at a museum exhibit or something like that, but to see one actually performed live.
Right. Yeah. That's interesting. It's definitely the same for me. And then shortly after that, after we became friends with those people, you know, the offhanded invitation to come to Sesame Street is always kind of crazy, because you become friends with these people that work on the shows, and then they're like, oh yeah, you should come by one day.
It's so funny, people have been trying to get me to come for years, but then COVID happened, but I
of course
plan to drop by as soon as they allow it.
Yeah, hopefully they'll reopen that, because that's you know, I have little kids too that I'm like, oh, I want to bring them there, because even as an adult, my first time going there, you know, you enter through Hooper's store. It wasn't even like you walk out on the street first, you enter through Hooper store and you're like, this is my childhood right here, right now. I can touch it and smell it. Like, so I hope that happens for you, Bob. I really do.
Yeah. I mean, I know enough people that it could, but
yeah.
But you know, restrictions and all.
Yeah, I'm not sure when they're gonna, because I've asked myself, like, when are you guys gonna do tours again? And they're still playing it tight. I mean, and now with the more recent COVID bump, who knows?
Mike, could we talk about Bear a little bit?
Of course. You
toured that thing.
Yeah, that was my very first professional gig. I think long-term professional gig right out of college. I got cast as Bear in Bear and the Big Blue House Live, the touring production. And I trained, like, the first puppet I put my most hours in is the Bear in the Big Blue House puppet. It was awesome. It was a, you know, slightly different than the one that Noel used on the show. Noel's bear was a little more custom fit to him. And this one was less custom fit to me, but it still was one of my favorite puppets. Noel had a double camera system set up where he would have both the camera feed and the camera in the eye, so he could have a little camera to look around. Whereas the one that we used on tour, it was just the camera in the eye. So the amount of vision that we had inside the puppet while performing the show was minimal. You could only see certain well-lit people and certain well-lit set pieces, which is why the stage had some molding on the floor so that we could tell when we were at center stage or not, and when we were downstage or upstage. And one of my funniest stories is at one point I was doing the show, and there was in the choreography, I was meant to take like 4 steps downstage. And what I didn't know downstage, for those that don't know, downstage means towards the audience. What I didn't know, because I couldn't see that well, was that I was already downstage. I was already the furthest you can go before you start to go to the audience. And I just continued to walk right off the stage and just took 2 big steps right off the stage and landed in the orchestra pit. Luckily, that tour did not have an orchestra pit. And luckily, I landed on my feet, but Bear pretty much took a stage dive during one of my performances.
That's epic.
I wish I could find a video of it. It would be pretty hilarious.
Yeah, a couple years ago in like 2015, on a different iteration of this podcast, I reunited some of the cast of that live tour. Like, we had Joe Kovac,
yeah, and
a bunch of the human cast.
That's awesome.
So are you anywhere on the pro shot on the DVD?
I don't know.
Because there's a DVD of that stage show.
Is there? I don't think I am. It depends on when it was filmed. I was doing it between May of 2001 and probably sometime in 2002.
So you might have been in it. I think it was summer 01. I'll look into that.
It's possible. Yeah.
But that's a fun little piece of history, because for a while there, Bear was huge. And Bear had a resurgence thanks to Disney Plus. But that was a cool live show. And did Noel like train or come visit you guys on that tour?
He did come out to visit. Both Noel did once, and Tyler Bunch. I think Tyler Bunch spent more time with us than Noel did.
I love those guys so much.
Yeah.
They're so kind and like giving with their time and great. So moving forward a little bit, a couple years back, there was this untitled puppet show that Apple was doing, and it was turned into Helpsters, and you guys did a ton of work on that. You guys basically built the entire world, pretty much, of the characters. So tell me that process, working with Sesame and Tim and all those guys to create this wonderful, wacky, irreverent, fun show that I honestly think deserves more love.
It is a wonderful show. Tim McKeon's a brilliant creator. So we were very excited and lucky that we got the chance to work with him. We designed the four main characters with Jeremy Holmes and Dan Cook, two friends and colleagues who work with us on and off when they're not busy being creative geniuses elsewhere. and then our team set to, you know, creating those in three dimensions, creating side characters too. It was fun, and we wound up getting an Emmy nomination out of it, which is something I never thought we could claim in our lifetimes. Unfortunately, Sesame wound up going a little bit different direction in the second season and third season, so we haven't been really involved with the show since the first season, which we're sad about, but you know, we feel lucky for the time we had with it and what happened through it. So I
specifically want to talk about Heart, because that's such a unique character, and the build for that is crazy.
Right. We're lucky. At times we work with David Valentine and James Voitall, who are both brilliant Muppet style builders who have built for the Muppets, built for Henson, built for Sesame. And they helped us, you know, kind of crash through making that monster, because, you know, she's a huge walk around and she's oddly shaped. You know, she's almost like an upside down eggplant. So she's really big and could be top heavy and difficult for somebody to perform. But David and James led the build with our team and managed to create, you know, amazing moving eyes, which Lars McLean brought to life. She was the eyeball remote puppeteer for that. We also had a lot of help from the great Jim Krupa.
Yeah, he built a mock-up mechanism for that.
The mech god.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, right. Another wonderful human being too. So we're lucky to have his help. And yeah, it was tricky because, again, she's such a big puppet, and Ingrid, who performed her, is not a large person. So it's as with any puppet, it's that tricky Venn diagram you're trying to match up of functionality and durability, but also lightness and ergonomics. So we're very happy with how things came out, because, again, it's anytime you're going from a two-dimensional character to a three-dimensional active puppet is going to be a challenge and tricky. And these were both created by, you know, people who have some puppetry knowledge, but, you know, not, they weren't necessarily designing them specifically to be with functionality in mind. They were thinking aesthetically firsthand, and they were getting notes from Sesame and Tim saying, hey, we want it to look more like this. So, you know, there are a lot of cooks throwing their spices into that pot. So even with all that, they turned out beautiful.
What I love about Helpster specifically is that every character's build or their functions are based on the personality of the character more than other shows. Like Mr. Prim likes to gesticulate a lot, so you have to adhere to that. Every puppet on that show, every character has their specific character traits that the puppeteering lends itself to. It's great.
Yeah, it worked out really well. It was really lovely how they cast that show and how everyone grew their characters.
And I think when I saw it, I was like, this is what we've been missing in puppetry. I was such a big advocate for that show, and I'm so sad that it's done now.
Yeah. But, you know, we try and hang on to the joy of that we got to be a part of it, so.
For sure.
And that it's out there. Like, that's one of the great things about the current age with all the streaming is you can go back and watch these things. When Mike and I were little, if you didn't catch it when it first ran, you're out of luck.
Or if you didn't record it on a tape or whatever.
Yeah, and that technology didn't come until, like, for me, it didn't come until I was almost in high school. Or at least it didn't become accessible. Like, you know, rich people may have had it when I was little, but, like, you couldn't afford a VCR until they were, like, on the market for 5 or 10 years. So, yeah, like, if you missed it, you're out of luck and just had to hope they would show it on reruns someday. So it's great now that you have streaming, and anytime you want to be like, oh, let's watch that episode and see how they did X, Y, or Z.
So for the both of you, what is the most fulfilling part of being a creative person? And on the flip side, what is the most challenging part for you about being a creative person?
More recently for me, it's been awesome to work on lots of the crazy things that people ask us to make. The fact that people are trusting us with making things that have never been done before, and then in turn we're trusting our awesome team to make these things that have never been done before, that's really cool to have that, to feel that way, you know, and to also be able to employ right now so many creative people. That's a really awesome thing for me as well, because, you know, lots of people that work with us are getting to work at their dream job, kind of. And we try not to take that for granted. We try to make sure that even though people are working at their dream job, that they're not overworking them, that it's still a balance between putting everything into the work that you're doing and having some rest at home.
Yeah, I pinch myself all the time, because it's crazy that I get paid to do what I do. And, you know, especially anytime we're walking into 30 Rock and, you know, walk in the same halls that, you know, Dan Aykroyd and Gilda Radner and all of them walked, like, it's surreal and wonderful. And I feel like skipping down the hall. And like Mike said, to run the business and to give all these wonderful creative people a chance to do what they love and get paid and keep creating cool stuff with them is just so great. And that, in on the other side of the coin, like you're talking about, also provides one of my greatest frustrations, is trying to figure out how we keep that going. And when we do run into slow times and we do have to lay people off or furlough people, it's the worst part of the job. It's, you know,
yeah.
You're like, hey, guess what? We can't give you money anymore. So good luck trying to figure out how you're going to pay rent and eat, you know? So that's a big stress point that, you know, I try and keep balanced with all of the joys that this job affords us.
So puppetry is a very, you know, it's very like physically, it's a physically tasked occupation. For those with disabilities like myself, puppetry might be a little difficult because of the hand dexterity. And how have you seen puppetry used for people with disabilities? Have you seen any adaptations for some? Like, what kind of stuff have you guys seen, if any?
Early on when I got into puppetry, one of my friend's moms found out, and she was working with a child with autism, and the child had a lot of stuffed animal friends. And she asked if I would bring one of my puppets over and just talk with him and have a conversation with him. And it was really, really amazing. I went and visited with this kid. He was probably like 8-ish. You know, he's a kid with autism, so I was expecting, you know, him to be either super quiet or not want to talk at all, because that's what my friend's mom had told me, because she was working with him and he was always having a hard time with communication. But as soon as I brought my puppet out of the bag I had and put it on and started talking to him with the puppet, you couldn't tell that he was an autistic child. And it was really beautiful that just because I had this sock on my hand, this stuffed animal on my hand, and was making it talk, that it made this child feel comfortable enough to be able to pretty much tell him almost anything. And we had like a nice long conversation just about school and about his friends and his stuffed animals and how I talk. And it was just really beautiful to see how art and creative performance can help people that, you know, have different needs. It was just really beautiful.
Because I've always wanted to puppeteer, but because of my hand dexterity, I couldn't do, I only type with one finger. So, you know, there has to be adaptable ways to do it now with different types of builds and whatnot.
Yeah, I would imagine that they can, you know, somebody could program a computer to then, you know, translate into more of an animatronic puppet, some motion. I know my friend Lindsay, unfortunately, came down with ALS about 9 years ago now, I think. She was not only a great puppeteer, she's an amazing dancer and artist and whatnot. And so now because of that, she is, you know, very physically limited to what she can do, but she still is finding a way to express her art, and she still does art painting with her feet.
That's amazing.
Yeah, and just trying to still express herself with what she still can do, rather than, you know, just be like, well, I used to be able to do that, I can't do that. She's amazingly strong human. So it gives me hope. And I know now that there's thankfully becoming more societal awareness, I'm hopeful that there will be more opportunities for people with disabilities to audition and, you know, have accommodations, whether it's, hey, you're going to work with a puppet on a stand, or we're going to build the set at a different height so you can be part of this. It's tricky. And it's, you know, my grandfather had polio when he was a little child. And as a result, he had a small leg and couldn't walk as well. He definitely instilled in myself and all of my cousins this idea of, like, you know, keep fighting, you know, but be aware of people and try and make sure that everybody has an opportunity. I'm hopeful that we keep growing as a society and affording people opportunities.
What I've had to learn is, like, I've been doing this podcast for over 13 years, and just adapting the setup so it doesn't lack quality is a challenge. But when you get it right, it's pretty amazing, because I taught myself all of this, and that's not a self-indulgent thing. I'm shocked by what I've been able to do.
That's awesome. It's hard for anybody to put together a podcast. I can't imagine if you're, you know, fighting an uphill battle of like, oh, I can't just go over and pick this up from the store, or I can't do this. Like, that's all the more impressive. You know, starting a podcast is tough enough. So
when I started talking to puppetry folks, because initially this podcast was me talking to literally punk rock musicians, and
nice,
a total 180 as to what we do now. And now it's more pop culture based and sort of, but
you sold out, Bob.
Nice. Yes. Yeah, absolutely. But I just feel like you realize that I just wanted to have conversations. I didn't want to be, so tell me about your new song. I just wanted to have conversations and sort of dial it back a little bit. And that's what really matters. You're not being interviewed. We're just having a conversation here.
Yeah, that's all the great podcasts are like that. They're not like a TV interview. They're conversational and it can go any direction. So that's very cool. Do you have, what's your favorite punk band then?
My favorite punk band. Well, it depends. Cause I'm more into like the late 90s type stuff. Like, maybe like wit and that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But when I was starting out, all these punk bands would come to me because they needed the prey.
Yeah.
And to think, like, I was 15 when I started doing this.
Wow.
Like, I can't believe that. Like, one of the interviews that I ended up doing, the lead singer of Smash Mouth, right?
Oh, yeah.
So I did an interview with him, and my equipment wasn't working, the gear wasn't working. And, you know, he said to me, "I don't have time for this, retard," and then hangs up on me.
Wow.
So I had to learn how to deal with different types of people and different types of viewpoints. But, you know, I'm not one type of person. I'll talk to you about puppets, but I'll also talk to you about MTV and comedy stuff. And it's like the one size doesn't fit all.
That's probably why you dig puppet people, because we are very eclectic. You know, like I told you, I did science. Mike studied jewelry design and computer design. We have a whole punk contingent here amongst our fabricators too, who you could probably talk with for hours. You know, there's a number of Bad Religion fans here, and
oh yeah.
Part of our team loves to do Metal Mondays, where they'll go, like, I'd realize it's different than punk, but like, it's a very eclectic crew here. And that's, I think, probably why you get along with all of us puppeteers, Bob, is we're an eclectic bunch. So I'm sorry you had to deal with that from the Smash Mouth guy. That's shitty.
No, it is what it is. And especially since I was younger, and it was my second year of doing the show, so I was still kind of new at it, and I was just doing it just to do it, and now it's become my job. And
that's awesome.
It's a cool thing.
It would have been very easy for you to just be like, "Well, that sucked. I'm not going to try this again." So, hats off to you.
I mean, literally, for every time I did a similar interview like that, like a band or something like that, I was like, are they going to be like that? I literally would say that to myself for the longest time.
Yep.
So, for the both of you guys, and this might cause some friction between you two, what is the hardest part about working with each other?
I think you're muted. Good, he's muted. He said all sorts of horrible things about me.
So many horrible things while I was muted. All I said was, we can't read each other's minds. Just remembering that you still need to talk about things.
Yeah, I feel very lucky, you know, to have Michael as my partner. Because despite all the times I mock Michael for how he communicates and his malapropisms, he's also a wonderful communicator. He's great about talking about things, like uncomfortable things, and being like, "Hey, this isn't going great. How do we fix this?" But also checking in with people. And he's very emotionally aware and intelligent. And so he'll check in with people when at the right times. And that's, I think, one of the big keys that keeps us going is just being open and honest with each other.
You gotta be a creative person too, because
right.
They'd be like, "Oh, that's great," when it really sucks.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, likewise, Mark and I have very different, we think very differently, but not too differently, if that makes sense. Mark is slow to act on things. I'm usually fast to act on things. So we bring ourselves to the middle. It works really well to be able to know that Mark is going to think of something from a different perspective, and that he'll bring it up so that we can talk about it and figure out our best path.
It's good yin-yang balance.
So as far as, like, current project, what are you guys working on? What's been cooking?
We can tell you, but then we'd have to kill you, Bob.
Okay, well.
We have been lucky enough to work with a lot of big theme parks lately, some of which we literally cannot talk about because of NDAs and whatnot. But making a range of puppets, some of them, you know, more like Muppet style hand and rod puppets, some of them larger walk around type things. We're also building a bunch of props for an installation on a cruise ship for a different client.
Got a couple Broadway shows that we're working with for some smaller props here and there, costume props and stuff like that. Still get a lot of phone calls for those.
Some potential practical effects for some Broadway stuff. There's a lot of stuff kind of circling the boat right now.
And that might be the hardest part about doing what you guys do is the waiting game. Like, are we doing this? Are we not?
Yeah.
Exactly. And, you know, there's some clients that are really great about letting you know when you didn't get a job, or of course, when you did get a job, it's easy for them to let you know. But we still spend a good amount of time just tracking people down and being like, what happened with this project? Are you guys still waiting? Like, we just need to know, is this a yes or a no? And sometimes people still ghost you, but the good ones, they'll let you know. They'll be like, sorry, we went with someone else this time. And, you know, it's annoying sometimes how much we have to hunt down people to figure out if we got a job or not.
You got to circle back, because you got to stay at the, if not the forefront, you got to stay close in people's minds.
And yeah.
Because otherwise, they might forget about it.
Yeah. It's definitely, I mean, it helped with SNL. You know, when we first got in there, it was because of our little shop puppets. And they were like, oh, cool, you can build this type of stuff. Great, we'll call you. And then we didn't hear from them. So we sent them like messages, and then we sent them like a care package with some stuff another time. And both times they were like, oh yeah, you guys, why don't you come try making this for us? So it definitely helped to refresh their memory.
Persistence is key.
For sure. Yeah. And that's why, you know, if you're going to try and do a career in the arts, you know, you have to be passionate about what you do so you can have that drive to keep doing it. Like, just same with you, you know, like with your podcast, if you weren't passionate about it, you probably would have been like, I don't need this type of abuse. I'm going to go do something else. But you loved it. You loved talking with people. So you kept pushing and kept finding people to talk to.
Yeah. And it's so funny because I feel like my podcast is stronger now because I never used to talk about my disability on this podcast at all. And when I started to, it created like a conversation that most of my talent that I have on isn't privy to. So you guys might learn something too, just by talking.
Absolutely.
On that note, do you guys have any questions for me about me or my work or disability or anything that you want to know? We're just meeting, and I don't mean to put you on the spot.
I don't mind. Is this your main podcast? How many podcasts do you do?
Just this one.
That's great.
How frequently do you do it?
I do 2 episodes a week, Monday, Friday.
Wow. That's a lot of content to put out. Where are you located? Generally speaking, you don't have to give your street address, because I know the listeners will be stalking you.
Long Island.
Oh, I went to college for science originally on Long Island, way out at the end.
When I bring up Long Island, a lot of people, like some people in LA are like, where? And I go, New York.
How do people not know Long Island?
I know.
Like, it's so ubiquitous in pop culture, even, you know, like how many things reference it? That's crazy.
That's why going to Sesame Street would be like just a train ride.
Yeah. The LIRR. I rode that many times.
I would love to take the trip to see your shop.
Yeah. If you're ever near Philly, it's an old building. So, it's not completely ADA compliant. Because it's always been occupied by little companies like us that were never forced to, you know, say put in an elevator or anything. But I'm sure we could figure out ways to to get you around.
Yeah, that'd be great. So where can people find you on social media?
They can go to our website, www.monkeyboysproductions.com, singular monkey, plural boys and productions. Or we have an Instagram account, and we post on that pretty regularly. We also have our Monkey Boys DIY puppet kits, which has its own Instagram account for people that would like to build their own puppet at home and or learn about it on the Instagram account. Our Instagram accounts are run by us and our production manager, Betsy, and most of it is done by one of our wonderful fabricators, Stephanie, who puts together all the awesome videos and montages you see on there. So check it out.
For the both of you, just to wrap up with a fun question. You have an embarrassing Michael Shupak story? We can embarrass
you. I don't know if there's any we can tell in public.
I mean, right?
So we know he's listening to this.
I definitely have ones I could not tell on this podcast.
Yeah.
Because we performed in some shows together and lived together at times.
Oh, boy.
He told me a funny story about a wonderful friend of ours who he was engaged to at one point. And they're considerably taller than him. Michael Shupak is not the tallest puppeteer. And this person he was dating was considerably taller. And they washed some dishes and put them away on the high shelf of the cupboard. And he's like, "You trying to starve me? What are you doing here?"
And that kebab king. Oh my God. Thank you guys so much for hanging out with me today. This has been great.
Our pleasure. Thanks for reaching out to us, Bob.
Thank you so much, Bob.
Thanks for hanging out with us at the DJ Bob Show. If you liked this episode, drop us a line at djbobrunkel@gmail.com. That's DJ Bob, RUNKEL @gmail.com. Let us know what you liked most about this episode and what other guests we should have on the DJ Bob Show. Thanks so much again for hanging out with us. This is Nate Beagle, your humble announcer.